Okay, today I would like to talk about spiritual independence and basically elaborate on our recent name change and corporate status change. As you know, in December we, as a membership or membership, decided to adopt changes that the board had proposed in terms of changing our name from Unity Church, which we can still call ourselves that because that's what we are, a Unity Church, but to make a formal change and then to formally declare our independence from our headquarters in Kansas City. And this was after long discussion and consideration and all of that kind of thing. But I would just like to talk about what independent unity means, how I see it, how I think it could be a very vital ministry in this community, and to also give the assurance that we still maintain our unity roots. We are still unity. Everything I knew about unity, I discovered back in 19, I was 16 years old. So it was quite a while ago, 1918 or something like that. I don't know what it is, a long time ago. A long time ago. But my whole thought of unity came from a book. My whole understanding of unity, I did not know about an organization, did not know that it had a board of directors or shareholders or any of the things that it had. I didn't care about the organization. And I think probably in most cases, we have only a mild interest in the organization. It's the message that we respond to. And when I read this book, Lessons in Truth, which I discovered later was Unity's basic textbook, in other words, they considered it, if you read this book, you'll have a very good idea of what the whole Unity message is about. And I have maintained that belief. I think Lessons in Truth, written by Dr. Emily Cady, back in the 1800s, is still the gold standard of defining the principles of unity. We are a Christian organization, but as I recently wrote on my blog site, on my website, that I would qualify that to say that I personally do not embrace much of mainstream Christian theology. What I embrace is what I consider the mystical thread that runs through the teachings of Jesus. There's a big difference. You know, today we talk about the difference between, you'll hear people say, I'm not a religious person, I'm a spiritual person. I'm not on a religious quest, I'm on a spiritual quest. And to me, it's a little like taking the suit off and putting on your blue jeans. You know, it's a natural approach. I don't want the trappings of a religion. And I don't care for it. You know, when I see the Pope get up and make some announcement and see all the entourage and all of the pomp and circumstance that surrounds that whole thing, I just have to think, what does that have to do with the message Jesus brought? And I'm convinced that the whole of the Christian message, well, I should say the whole of the gospel of Jesus, which we don't have a formal gospel of Jesus, but I think the closest thing we have is this parable of the prodigal son, that no matter how far we stray from our spiritual source, we can always come home. And we come home, we don't have to cross a toll gate. We don't have to cross something that says, do you accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior? Do you believe in the Bible? Do you believe in the second coming? Do you believe, you know, in all the things we're supposed to believe in? Do you believe you're a born sinner? There is none of that in that parable. The son sins about as bad as you can sin in the story, and I think Jesus specifically made that story that radical, so he was saying, you can't do it so badly that there's no return, there's no hope of return. The son, out in the far country, came to himself, and he turned and he began to go home, and he started rationalizing, you know, if I tell my father, you know, I'll confess, I sinned against you, I sinned against God, I've sinned against everybody, and I'll be happy to come back as a servant. He was making all this stuff up in his mind about how he would work a deal with his father so he could be accepted back home. And that's sort of how we think about the whole spiritual thing. And the point Jesus was making is that has nothing to do with reality. Because when the son gets home, the father sees him from a distance and goes out to greet him in joy. Calls for the fatted calf to be butchered and a meal to be prepared and, you know, a great celebration. He doesn't say anything. The son starts explaining, you know, his deal. You know, Father, I really messed up here. And Father stops him pretty much in midstream and says, don't worry about that. In my mind, you were dead and now you're alive. And that's all that matters. So you don't see any of that conditional acceptance or conditional salvation in this story. And I think it's one of the best presentations. And that's how I think. That's how I feel about God. That's how I, because I, like everyone, has felt very much alone spiritually, like God is some distant concept that has no bearing on what's happening in my life. And how do I bring that into my life? How do I open myself to that? And yet in the times where I feel the closest, I realize that that's just my perception. I'm in the far country trying to figure out how to get back home and trying to figure out what I need to do, all the things I need to do to appease God, who would obviously be put out with my foolishness. And that's the anthropomorphic God, the human-like figure that most of us grew up with. And that's a hard thing to get over. But if I am working a math problem and I say 2 and 2 is 5, obviously it's the wrong answer, but am I punished by the law of mathematics, or am I punished by my sin, by my mistake? In other words, I believe 2 and 2 is 5, and I go through life trying to make that true. And people I meet just kind of raise their eyebrows, and, you know, I talk about how all this 2 and 2 is 5 and how I can prove it. You know, you put two cars together, and 2 cars, 2 and 2 cars together, and you get 5. You get 5 cars. Well, they look at you like you're nuts. So it's the punishment is in the effect of holding an error. It's not a principle that's punishing you. It's the perception you hold. And that is where the young man, the prodigal son, was punished. It was in his own thinking. He thought he'd really made some bad mistakes, so he suffered over that. He suffered, by those mistakes, but he also suffered thinking that he was so bad that he had to do something to fix those mistakes so he would be accepted again. Isn't that a pretty prominent part of the Christian message? Because we're told that if you don't accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, you won't get into heaven. You'll be in the far country and you'll go home, you'll die someday, and you will stand at the pearly gates. St. Peter will be looking at your resume, and he'll say, I don't think you quite made the cut. So you'll say, well, I thought God is love. Well, God is love, but you still don't make the cut. It's like, it's the fear of eternity and hell that keeps us on the straight and narrow. And most of us don't stay on the straight and narrow anyway. Even a lot of professed Christians do not stay on what they define as the straight and narrow. But there's always some way to justify it. The Catholic Church, and I'm not picking on the Catholic Church, but they have confession. You just pay a couple of bucks and wipe yourself free of sin. Confess your sins. There's a way around it. And it's a good fundraiser, I guess. We might do that here. I don't know. We're thinking about it. But that's, when you think about all of the theological problems, Emerson called them the mumps and measles of religion, of the spiritual way. They don't exist in reality. We live and move and have our being in this presence that we call God. You can call it anything you want and it won't be offended. But it is a creative life force. It is our heartbeat. It is the very essence of our soul. And we cannot separate ourselves from it. It's again the sponge in the water, immersed in the water. The water is in the sponge is in the water. I'm in the Father's in me. But the Father is greater, the water, the ocean is greater. But it's the same water, it's the same Spirit. We are immersed in God. God is not an old man up in the sky. That's just a way to get us to conceptualize. We talk about the Almighty, and it's hard to think of that as an energy force. It's not hard to think of it that way, but we have made God into a man so we can grasp infinity, so we can grasp this idea. It's the same as the term space. Outer space. What is that? We don't know. But if you think outer space, what might come to your mind is a picture of a galaxy or a series of galaxies, something from Hubble, that Hubble shot. And we think that's outer space. Do you realize that you live in outer space? Do you realize you're part of that? Remember when Voyager went out and turned the camera and shot a picture of the Earth and we saw the little blue dot for the first time? I wrote a song about that. It's an incredible picture because it makes us realize we're already in outer space. We're already there, and we have spent generations thinking we're the center. We're it. We're all there is. We don't know if there's other life out there. I can imagine that there is someplace intelligent life. I'm hoping still that we'll find it on Earth one of these days. We're working pretty hard at looking for that. But right now we're the best it has, so we should make the best of that. But when you think about religion, as opposed to my spiritual journey, my personal spiritual awakening, you'll probably experience an emotional gulf, an abyss between what's really important to you and what you were taught, what you learned along the way. And I don't really criticize it in the sense that I appreciate the exposure I've had to mainstream Christianity. And that was in my youth, went to the Christian church, which I think is, I'm not sure the name of that. Anybody know that? Christian church is, it's not Latter-day Saints, it's Mormon. But anyway, I went to the Christian church and then to a branch of the Baptist church. And so I got all of the nuts and bolts of Christian theology, and it's pretty much all the same. I've done a lot of study since then about different Christian denominations, and they basically all say the same thing. They start with the idea that we are separate from God. God is someplace else, mostly thought of as in the sky. And we're here on this planet. God's kind of looking down and watching everything, and usually with a lot of disgust and just kind of marking the ones that are going to be saved. You know, I think Revelation talks about the 144,000, which leaves most of us out because they're all from the 12 tribes of Israel. So, and if you have, maybe check into your ancestry to see if you're going to be. But that has nothing to do with reality. All of us are saved. All of us are okay. We're all the prodigal son. We forget our oneness with God, but we come back and the door's open. You don't have to go to a specific church or be of a particular religion. What religion is God? You know, God is not of any religion. Religions are born of people. So the word independent in our name, independent unity, the word means free from outside control, autonomous, not subject to another's authority or jurisdiction. And we can think of this in two ways, and I like to think of this in two ways. The first is that the term independent states our organizational status as an autonomous nonprofit Colorado corporation. And we have nearly always been that. We were a member of the Association of Unity Churches that now does business as Unity Worldwide Ministries. But we've always been autonomous in that we got our 501c3, I think in 1957, 58, 59, something like that, way back there. I was about three or four when they got it. So we've had that status for a long time. And to me, that's the least important. Legally, it's the most important. You know, when the IRS looks at you and all that, you've got to fulfill all the obligations of a legal corporation. You have to have bylaws and all of those things. But that's not why I ever got involved in a church, is to know all that stuff. It's interesting, and it comes in handy to understand it. But the important aspect of the word independent reflects the type of independent thinking that makes the path of spiritual discovery our own. And that's what unity has always encouraged. And I think Jesus encouraged that, to go alone, to go into the inner closet, as he said, shut the door. Pray to the Father who's in secret. And what is that inner closet? What is that secret place? It's that place where the universal becomes you, becomes personal. It's that place in the sponge where the ocean becomes water in the sponge. You know, there's no place where one leaves off and the other begins. It's one. Our experience with God must be firsthand in order to be real to us, in order for our faith to become a knowing. And that requires independent thinking. It doesn't, you're not qualified as an independent by just going to a Unity church to join some group that says, you know, this group believes that God is within, so therefore I'm part of this group, and therefore that's not an experience. That is a philosophy. And you carry that philosophy in your back pocket, and somebody says, what church do you go to? I go to Unity. That's supposed to mean something. And it does mean something. But what does it mean to you? Jesus asked his disciples one time, you know, who do people say that I am? They all gave different answers. Some say John the Baptist, some say one of the prophets. which indicates they believed in reincarnation, because if he was one of the prophets, he would have been, even John the Baptist, had been brought back, which is another topic. But that's the question that he asked them, and they gave him all these answers, and then he said, "Who do you say that I am?" And that was the most important question. And Peter's answer was the most important answer, that thou art the Christ. And he commended Peter by saying that flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you. You've had a mystical awakening, a first-hand experience. And that's all the mystical awakening means. You've had a first-hand experience with your Creator, with that living essence that you call God, or you call it whatever you want. Jesus called it his Father. And I like that. And there are people that don't like it because it's masculine. But I understand what he means by it. I think we get into some silly arguments about that kind of stuff. There are moves to take the whole Bible and make it gender neutral. It didn't come out of a gender neutral culture. And if we cannot read something that came out of a culture without being offended by it, then we have a problem. So we got to go back and rewrite history and change that culture. But the meaning is no clearer. It doesn't matter if you call God mother or father, or mother father, as we sometimes do. If you haven't had a first-hand experience, you're just giving it lip service. It's a concept. And so we want to have a first-hand experience, and that requires independent thinking. We read other people. We study. We listen to other ideas, and we observe how we respond to these. And I've said many times, if you go through all of your inspirational books, if you're a highlighter, and you look at your highlights, what you will end up with, if you put them all together, is the gospel according to you. That person wrote or said something that you respond to, but why do you respond to it? Why does that mean something to you? It's because you arrived at that place first, but they just put it into words. But we discount that in ourselves. We say, I love this author. Why do we love this author? Because he tells me what I already know is true at the deepest level, but nobody's ever said it before. I've never read it or heard it. And I think that's what happened to me when I read Emily Cady's book. It was like every page was on fire. And I felt like the prodigal son that had come home, that I was hearing something that was strangely familiar, but put in a way that I'd never actually read. So what is that? And what our spiritual education is, really, is it's not learning things we don't know. It's uncovering what is in us, but we don't know how to say it. We don't know how to put it in words. When I first discovered this, people would say, why do you like that book? What is it so interesting to you about that? And I couldn't tell them. And when I started telling them, I started speaking in tongues. It's hard to describe it. Why do you like this? I don't know. I just do. It's true. So it's taken me 40-some years to be able to talk about it in a way that I hope you can understand. It's not easy to talk about because most of the world has not a clue. They say, what church do you go to? They mean, how do you think? How were you trained to think about God? Not what do you think, but how were you trained to think? Oh, you go to the Baptist church. Well, it tells me a lot about you. You're a Mormon. Yeah, I understand you now. So an independent thinker is one who will step off that path. We don't identify with the place for what it professes, but for what it encourages in us as individuals. And that's what the Fillmores represented, Charles and Merle Fillmore, the co-founders of the Unity Movement. They consider themselves eclectic. They drew from many sources, many teachings that encouraged the practice of universal spiritual principles. From these many sources, however, they drew their own conclusions. And that's really important. The examples of the Fillmores, you know, we say, do you embrace unity? When somebody would ask me that at some point, or what do you represent, unity, I would try to tell them what unity believes. But that's not the core of unity. Unity is like a tool that helps us articulate what we know is true at the deepest level. In other words, we don't go memorize Charles and Myrtle Fillmore's teachings. That's not enough. It's good to read them, good to be exposed to them. What we want to do is do what they did. And I don't mean go out and start a new spiritual movement. But what did they do? James Dillett Freeman, who is he's known as Unity's poet, he has a poem on the moon. One of the astronauts, or maybe a couple of them, took microfilm of one of his poems up there. But in the book Story of Unity, Freeman writes, speaking of Charles Fillmore, he had an instinctive urge to seek out the meaning of life. He was the kind of person who had to find the meaning in his own soul. He had to find God for himself. Other persons might point the way. Others might give him hints and clues. But he would have to test their ideas for himself and prove them in his own mind and his own life before they would have validity for him. What he's describing there is the attitude every person in this type of thought should have. That is, you hear ideas, but are they yours? Have you made them yours? Who do you say that I am? What is coming out of you? What is coming from you? And it's a very major distinction, because I would ask the question, you know, when I was engaged, involved with many of my colleagues in the Unity Movement, what I started saying is, you know, do we want to preserve the history of Unity, the teachings, all of the books and everything? And yes, we do. We want to have those archives. But we want to make sure that we are teaching, you know, what made Charles Fillmore, Charles Fillmore? What made Emily Cady, Emily Cady? What made Emma Curtis Hopkins, Emma Curtis Hopkins? What made any spiritual leader who they are, who they were, the light that they became? That's what we want to do. We want to do what they did. And I think that's what Jesus was talking about when he said, the things I do, you can do also in greater things, because I go to the Father, I go to the source. I believe when he said, follow me, he's not saying, worship me, you know, walk in my footsteps. Do what I'm doing. Go to the Father. Go to your Father. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Not my God, your God. Find yours. Don't just hang on every word I say. Let your inspiration be yours. Open yourself to that living fountain. Spend time daily in that inner closet, praying to the Father in secret. And he said, the Father who hears in secret will reward you openly. And that's true. Openly being your life begins to work. Because you find your own foundation. You begin to build your house of consciousness, of thought, of self-perception on the rock of your own spirituality, not on the shifting sands of personality and of religious beliefs and all the surface things that define so many people in our society. I am who I am because of the group I belong to. But you'll never see a true leader say that. The true leader starts the group. The true leader stands up. They go apart. You know, what made a Gandhi a Gandhi? What made a Martin Luther King Jr.? What made an Emerson Emerson? What made Abraham Lincoln Abraham Lincoln? What made anybody that has stood out? They have had to go a path, walk a path that nobody walked before. And we think they're different. We think they're different than us, and they're not. We are all created in the image and after the likeness of God. We're not all reflecting that. Some of us are reflecting the beliefs of others. We go through life reflecting the beliefs of others, rather than the knowing that we ourselves possess. So Fillmore was not a follower. He was not an educated man. He had no education at all, just a couple of years in grade school. He was self-taught. But if you ever read any of his books, you'll think he went to Harvard or something. He's was able to brilliantly express spiritual ideas, and they're unique to him. Many of them are unique to him. He did study other people, and he did reflect that in his writings. But there is a level of him that was unique, and the whole unity movement came out of that independent thinking. So we're not interested in starting new movements. We're interested in a spiritual path that is absolutely meaningful, that's ours. It's comfortable. And it's disconcerting. That is, it continually challenges us to look at things in different ways. We benefit from the inspired words of others, but we make the most progress when we drink from that same well of inspiration that they point to. We advance in understanding when we free our mind of dogmatic statements of faith that define the thinking of so many followers of mainstream religion. Adhere less to religious dogma and more to your own personal spiritual inquiry. Eric Butterworth, who was one of our great ministers and passed away a few years ago, but he said he was speaking at a college one time about unity principles, and one of the students asked him a question about something, and he turned the question back on the student. The student said, "What does unity think about this or that?" And Butterworth turned the question back to the student asking the question. He said, "What do you think about it?" And he said the student was kind of had a sort of a blank look on his face and turned to the instructor in the room and said, "What do we think about that?" So if we have to say that, you know, it's understandable. What does unity say about this or that? That's understandable. And you want to know the answer. But the most important response is, what do you say about it? And what I like about inspirational works is they get me closer to myself. They confirm what I know at the deepest level. And I think Emerson pointed that out too when he said somebody will come along and say something brilliant, but you thought it 5 minutes earlier. We just don't give ourselves credit. We don't feel like we are spiritual authorities. There are so many books, so many teachers, so many things out there that make us feel small in that regard. Just get off that path is what we need to do. Okay, the inclusion of unity in our name, Independent Unity, is intended to assure members and friends that we retain our rich heritage that is rooted in Unity School of Practical Christianity, the unity of our founders. Emily Cady's book, Lessons in Truth, remains, as I said in the beginning, the gold standard for capturing the principles embodied in the Unity philosophy. Nothing about this organization is going to noticeably change. The teachings that we embody will always be for the purpose of encouraging you to awaken to that inner place where you know your God. And if you don't know how to do that, that's what we want to be here to help do. We can't give you anything. Just imagine a well that we can all go to, and most cases spiritual teachers will go to the well and bring the bucket back and give it to the followers. But this church is all about teaching you to go to the well, how to do that, how to be still, how to have a firsthand experience with God. You think that's not possible? It is. And that's what we want. And that's what we represent. All right? So I'm going to spend the next couple of weeks just talking about different aspects of this whole thing and hopefully make it clear as to what you're part of now. All right, thanks for coming out. We'll see you next week.